This podcast is made possible through listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina. And the Florence County Museum, presenting Kindred Spirit, The Personal Worlds of William H. Johnson, exploring the painter's artistic evolution and journey of self-discovery from rural South Carolina to Europe and New York, flocomuseum.org. And Meadow Garden, home of George Walton, one of the youngest signers of the Declaration of Independence. Open for tours Monday through Friday, 10 to 4. Learn more at historicmeadowgarden.org and visit augusta.com.
From South Carolina Public Radio, this is Walter Edgar's Journal. I'm Walter Edgar, welcoming you to our podcast series about South Carolina culture and history with a nod to all things Southern. Today, Alfred Turner and I will be talking with Nathan Canastero, author of The Mighty Move, the USS Cowpens and her epic World War II journey from jinx ship to the Navy's first carrier in Tokyo Bay.
The Mighty Move tells a story of a World War II aircraft carrier and its untested crew who earned a distinguished combat record and beat incredible odds to earn 12 battle stars in the Pacific.
Against the expectations of many, USS Cowpens and her band of second-string reservists and citizen sailors served the Navy with distinction, fighting in nearly every major carrier operation in the Pacific from 1943 to 1945. Nathan, great to have you on the Journal today. Let's tell our listeners a little bit about yourself. You're not from South Carolina.
I'm not. I claim Knoxville, Tennessee is my hometown, but I'm currently living outside of Washington, D.C., where I'm an intelligence officer for the federal government.
Okay. What did you do between Knoxville and D.C. and a little bit about yourself?
I kind of grew up all over the East Coast and went to college and law school in Knoxville. My family's still there. So, when I think about my hometown, that's it. But I have been with the federal government for 25 years now. So came straight from Knoxville to D.C., started as a, 22 or 23-year-old getting into national security and the intelligence business. I've been there ever since. Still did a little bit of other colleges, grad schools, things like that, some overseas service in support of the war on terror. But it's been here in Washington for the duration.
Okay, you're not a professional historian, although I might say you write very well. How did you get interested in the USS Cowpens? I mean, those of us from South Carolina, very familiar with the Battle of Cowpens.
And for those of us who've moved to South Carolina recently, let's just quickly tell everybody what the Battle of Cowpens was. It was an amazing event in the Revolutionary War.
It was the finest tactical victory of the war, which is especially remarkable given the good chunk of the troops that were used to fight the British, who were professional soldiers, were militiamen with no training. And the colonials essentially routed the British, flanked them on both sides, drove them from the field. And I believe the colonel in charge described it as a devil of a whipping. And it set the stage for Yorktown and was sort of the climactic battle for the Revolutionary War in the South.
Well, and actually of the Revolution itself. For a number of years, I was an adjunct professor at the Commander General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, and they still studied the Battle of Cowpens. Double envelopment, perfect military tactic. All right, so Nathan, how did you get interested in the USS Cowpens?
Probably the simplest way to describe it is it's a failed genealogy project. My grandfather was a naval aviator in the Second World War. He was part of Torpedo Squadron 22, which served aboard the Cowpens from summer 44 to February or March of 45. And like a lot of soldiers and sailors from that era, he didn't talk about the war. It was a painful period in his life. It was very difficult. And, he gave me just enough to sort of be intrigued about what had happened. And particularly towards the end of his life, a few more stories started bubbling up out of him. But it as someone who sort of researches, you know, military operations and military history for a living, I said, well, let me see what I can find out on my own. You know, what, find out what Grandpa wouldn't tell me. And it quickly came across some problems. First, Grandpa was an enlisted man, and the Navy's record keeping, while very, very good, mostly focused on its officers. And also his, the type of aircraft that he was flying, he was the tail gunner in, by the time he arrived in the war, it was of declining utility to the Navy. It was a torpedo bomber, and most of the Japanese fleet had been driven back towards the home islands. There was not a whole lot of use for torpedoes. So I didn't find out a whole lot about Grandpa. I know he's there. I have some photos. I could sort of see his paper trail when he checked in and out of the ship. But in so doing, I found this really remarkable story about his ship, the Cowpens, and also the men with whom he served. And I commented to my wife at the time. I'm like, you know, I think there's a book here. And she's like, oh, yeah, you should totally do it. And I don't think either of us realized at that moment how deep the Cowpens rabbit hole really went. But it was 5 years to research, three to write, and a lot of sort of chasing down families of veterans and talking to them and gathering sort of a scavenger hunt, gathering documents, not only the official government documents, but diaries and letters and you know, all sorts of things that helped me sort of piece together this very large puzzle, I think would be the only way to describe it.
All right. Well, let's start with the lady herself, the USS Cowpens.
Yeah. The story of the Cowpens and her sister ships, of which there were eight others, is kind of an overlooked part of naval history in the Second World War. And I think a lot of Americans forget how rough things were going for the U.S. Navy in the Pacific that first year of the war. You know, we started the war with six carriers, and within 12 to 18 months, four of them had been sunk. So I'm just sort of from a modern eye, I can't imagine the political firestorm if, you know, the U.S. Navy went to war today and in a year we lost two-thirds of our carriers. But President Roosevelt knew that, you know, he had a problem even before the war started, in that he knew war was coming. He knew, while the Navy was building this sort of next generation of larger fleet carriers called the Essex, he knew that they probably weren't going to be available in sufficient numbers fast enough. And he started pressing the Navy to find ways to come up with more flat tops for the fight. And Navy wasn't really interested in all this. They liked their big expensive platforms and the idea that perhaps you could do something a little cheaper, a little more austere, a little less capable, really just wasn't a good sync with their culture. But FDR prevailed. And in the end, what they ended up doing was they took nine light cruisers, which are reasonably small ships, you know, about 11, 12,000 tons, and converted them into aircraft carriers. And they had a lot of problems as an aircraft carrier. It's not the sort of ship that you would accept in the most desperate of circumstances, which is where the Navy was in that first year. They were small. They were kind of narrow and tall. They had a very narrow flight deck, only 73 feet wide. They were unstable in high seas. They only carried 33 aircraft. They had some of the highest accident rates in the fleet because of all these things. And for their crew, they were really uncomfortable, you know, because the original cruisers were 1,300 people aboard, and they bumped that up to 1,500 to support, you know, the aircraft and the maintenance and things like that. But FDR was right because, you know, given the losses and the fact that these ships could be built very, very quickly, they covered the nickname for them was they called them the stopgap sisters. You know, they were something that could fill in the gap in between the initial losses and the arrivals of the Essexes later on. And for the climactic battle for naval aviation in World War II, which was the Marianas Turkey Shoot in June of 1944, half of the American carrier decks were these little light carriers, and two presidents served aboard them. So in terms of, you know, kind of having a place in history, both H.W. Bush served and Gerald Ford both served aboard these little light carriers.
Well, you've got a picture, and it really is an ugly duckling kind of ship. You've got this tall tower, which I can see where that led to the instability. And if I remember right, they had to pump in all sorts of concrete into one of the ballast tanks when they built it to make sure it wouldn't tip over.
Yeah. And even still, they had, if the fuel tanks were empty, they had a 4 to 6 degree list to one side. They would usually compensate for that, you know, put fuel in the tanks by pumping more to the other side. But the ship's newspaper had a cartoon of a sailor walking down the street, you know, having just gotten off the Cowpens, and he has a 4 to 6 degree list to the other direction, trying to compensate. So not only sort of the character of the ship, the name of the ship, people just sort of adopted the eccentricities of this thing, that it was an ugly duckling, that, and the name was ridiculous. But, you know, they latched onto it with pride. You know, it's the first captain of the ship, a man by the name of Robert McConnell, really didn't care for the ship's name. And he didn't leave any documents to explain why, but I'm assuming he didn't think it was serious enough for a, you know, a man of war. So he tried to get people to pronounce it Cuppins. And
oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it just didn't take. The crew was just not having it.
USS Cuppins.
That didn't work. And eventually, it became, you know, they stuck with Cowpens, and then the Moo, and then the Mighty Moo. And then, you know, you just sort of had to smile and just embrace the element of nonsense in the name.
And they painted a mural of a rather large bull on the tower, did they not?
They did. yes. With certain portions of the anatomy exaggerated. Mm. My grandfather used to say that when they came into port, they had to paint over particular portions of the bull logo because it would upset the civilians.
Okay. And keeping with history, the ship was launched on the anniversary of the Battle of Cowpens in New York, actually New Jersey. It was the New York Shipbuilding Company, but actually in New Jersey, ahead of schedule. And for the first time, the captain and crew got together. And a big part of the crew, and I think actually separate, are the pilots. The flight folks are not really on the crew. Well, you explain it to us. I was interested in that.
Yeah, there's an interesting parallel between the Revolutionary War Battle of Cowpens and the ship itself. The Revolutionary War battle, the bulk of the people who were fighting were militiamen. They weren't professional soldiers. And the same was true of the ship. Most of the guys who went aboard the Cowpens, the crew, were essentially fresh out of boot camp. These were reservists, people that would return to civilian life after the war was over. A lot of them were 17 or 18 years old. So it was very much the ship full of teenagers. There were a handful of Naval Academy grads aboard, the sort of professional sailors. But even the bulk of the pilots, you know, these guys weren't first stringers. Most of the pilots actually self-trained on the planes they'd fly into battle. You know, they had some experience in the previous generation of aircraft, but, you know, they were essentially – the manufacturer dropped off a couple of Hellcats and a couple of Avengers on the airfield and said, here you go, boys. You know, you guys figure out how to fly it. And so for Captain McConnell, the first captain of the ship, he was actually also not a Naval Academy grad, which was very unusual at the time. He started his career as an enlisted man as well. They called it a Mustang. But he had to turn this mob of inexperienced sailors and green pilots into a combat-ready team, and he didn't have a lot of time to do it. He only had a few weeks. And unfortunately, they had a handful of incidents which made people start to think, well, maybe there's something wrong with the ship. Maybe there's a jinx here.
You talk about the jinx throughout the book, but actually on one occasion, because of mishaps, the Mighty Moo was not in a certain location and the ship that was there sank.
Yeah, they had sent her sister Independence off to fight at Rabaul, and she wasn't hit. But at the time, the rumors were flying that she had taken heavy losses, like a third of her crew had been killed, blah, blah, blah. None of it turned out to be true. But at the time, it got the crew's thinking, well, maybe our luck is starting to turn. Maybe this is we were spared a worse fate, because at the time they'd had a collision with another destroyer. It actually sliced into their side, and they were right. From there on, the ship's luck really, really did turn. And if perhaps there's, you know, the biggest indication of it's, you know, although they got off to a rocky start, Cowpens was never hit by the enemy in 26 months in combat, which given how tough some of that resistance was there, particularly in, you know, 44 and early 45, that's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, the people think of the kamikazes at that time, and particularly the battles that she was involved in the Pacific. Other ships were hit by kamikazes.
Yeah, she had a number of very close calls. The crew knew that the carriers were the target. You know, if you were a Japanese torpedo bomber or a kamikaze, they wanted to hit the flat tops. And the pilots joked, or the crew joked amongst themselves, what they needed was a big neon sign on the deck that says, "The big carriers are over there." so there was kind of this tongue-in-cheek approach, but they had there's a particular incident off the coast of Taiwan in the fall of 44. Taiwan was a Japanese stronghold. There's tons of airfields there. And the fleet was, you would steam in formation. And so the carriers would sort of be on the inner ring, and then you'd have a sort of an outer ring of cruisers and destroyers that would protect them. They're attacked about dusk one evening, and a torpedo bomber drops this torpedo, and it passes just to the stern of Cowpens and hits one of her escorts, the Canberra, which was steaming nearby. So they pull Canberra out of formation, and they put another cruiser in, the Houston. And the very next night, the exact thing happens again. Another torpedo bomber comes in, just barely misses Cowpens, and hits Houston, which is now in Canberra's place there in the formation. So there had just been a number of just very, very close calls in terms of enemy action.
Okay, Nathan, let's talk a minute about the research. You mentioned the official Navy records, but you also went looking for the men who had served aboard, diaries, journals, letters, and that kind of thing. That's part of the 5 years your research.
Yeah, I was very fortunate that I did find a number of family members of folks who were pretty important parts. I mean, there was one exception, but by and large, almost everyone I contacted were eager to deal with me. You know, because Cowpens isn't, when you think about the naval war in the Pacific, hasn't drawn a lot of attention. And so consequently, these families are like, yes, we really do want our relatives' stories to be told. One is Bob Price. If there is one person whose story overlap, who is sort of the Cowpens story, it's Bob Price. And he started as the commander of the ship's first fighter squadron, and then became the commander of its first air group, and then later on returned for a second deployment as the ship's air officer. And his family had donated all of his letters home to the Naval Aviation Museum in Pensacola. And reading through these, it was a huge stack of letters back to his wife, you could take those letters and sort of add that personal, what was it really like? And he was a good writer and had a sort of a keen eye for people. And it, particularly when you put the letters up against the official documents, you know, because oftentimes the letters had to go through a censor to make sure they didn't disclose any operationally sensitive information. But if you put it against sort of the official records and did a timeline, he would sometimes allude to things that you could say, oh, this is what he's talking about. He made one comment: the ship's first combat operation at Wake was a total disaster. And, you know, the ship lost 3 planes to accidents, 3 more shot down, and 4 men killed. And it was very tough for everyone because this is a small ship and everyone knows everyone else. And Bob said something to the effect of, you know, faces sometimes fall by the wayside and it's hard going, but over time we just have to grow to become callous to that. And unless you'd known exactly what is sort of going on in the records, that one-off comment wouldn't have made sense. But when you put them together, it really did provide a sort of a powerful personal perspective on what was going on.
For the non-aviation crew, the 1,300 guys were crammed into a facility, and they're in the South Pacific. When the battle klaxon goes off, they seal everything up.
Yeah.
You described that, I think, beautifully, if that's the term, of what it was like for those poor guys there. Not the most pleasant living conditions in the world, the best of circumstances. Nothing was air conditioned, right?
There were a few compartments that were air conditioned, but mainly with the radars and things like that, the bulk of the ship was not. And, you know, because this is a, sort of a bootleg carrier to begin with, the air vents that sucked in fresh air weren't on the flight deck. They were actually in the hangar bay. So they wouldn't even necessarily get the benefit of sort of the cooling ocean breezes. So at night, you know, the whole place was locked up, you know, all the doors and hatches shut so no light would leak out. And temperatures, you know, in some of these compartments were easily 100 and in some cases were 120 or 130 degrees, you know, when everything was shut down. And folks would fight over the fan at night. You know, they'd go to sleep with it blowing on you and wake up in the middle of the night in a pool of your own sweat. And somebody else had moved the fan someplace else, or, you know, they would cut whole, widen the size of the air vents so they would get more air at the expense of people down the line. And so a lot of sailors sometimes took to sleeping on deck, on the flight deck. They'd go up there and just be up, and you could, you know, when the ship was underway, you'd get a little bit of a breeze. But, you know, you also had problems with heat rash and malaria. If you were sweating all the time for days and days and days, you eventually get blisters and rashes, and it was tough. But now, that being said, if you had asked a sailor, why is it you're here in the Navy? Why did you, you know, a lot of these guys were volunteers. And the answer was almost always the same. Well, being in the Navy is a heck of a lot better than being an infantryman. You know, their fathers and their uncles had told them, like, what life was like in the trenches of World War I, and they didn't want any part of it. And for a sailor, as austere as it was, there were three square meals a day. There was a roof over your head. And compare that to a guy who is, you know, in the first wave of an amphibious landing in the Marines, you know, for despite all their hardships, the sailors knew that they had a pretty good thing going here. And it was just a motivation for them to join the Navy to begin with.
One thing we haven't covered yet is how the Cowpens got its name, which of course comes back to Cowpens, South Carolina in the 20th century.
Yeah. So the town of Cowpens also takes its name after the battle. I think they named this the town in honor of it in the late 19th century. But at the time, carriers were named either after previous ships or after battles. And, you know, you had Lexington and Yorktown and Saratoga and all of those ships. And a pharmacist in Cowpens, a guy by the name of George Dean Martin, sent a postcard to the White House and said, hey, can we have a carrier that's named after the battle? And FDR signed off on it, passed it along to the Navy Department, and they changed, you know, if you remember, all of these ships were started as cruisers and they had different names. And so they essentially renamed this ship that was partially under construction at the time from Huntington, which was the original, to Cowpens, and the rest is history.
And the lady who launched it was Admiral Bull Halsey's daughter.
Yes. He was obviously a very popular and well-known, I mean, probably the most popular admiral in the United States in the early phases of the war. This was a guy who would brag about how his forces were killing Japanese, and, you know, at a time when the news was all very, very bad. So, you know, the fact that he was just sort of so bellicose really made him very popular on the home front. But his daughter christened the ship, and at the end of the war, when Cowpens ended up, sort of to everyone's surprise, being the only U.S. aircraft carrier in Tokyo Bay to witness the surrender, some people thought, well, you know, maybe the reason why that is because Admiral Halsey had this soft spot for the ship that his daughter christened.
Well, you have a wonderful quote from Halsey when the captain of another carrier wanted to know why his wasn't there, and Halsey's was basically, the Cowpens earned it.
Yeah, mind your own business. It's partly that, but he did have another reason, and it's sort of the irony of it is, Halsey, when the Japanese surrendered, there were a lot of folks in the Navy, in the military writ large, who wasn't entirely convinced it was the real thing, that they thought that this was going to be a trap, that the Japanese were going to, you know, essentially lure them in and then attack them. And so Halsey had all his big carriers, all his valuable fleet carriers, and he wanted them way the heck away from any trouble. So they were all out to sea. And the irony is, you know, Cowpens got this great glory that she would be the only U.S. carrier present because she was expendable. Halsey could do without her.
Wow.
And
just,
yeah.
Wow.
Now, granted, there was a lot of other warships. It wasn't just her. So, you know, sure, she did have some protection. But for Halsey, he was protecting the carriers that were irreplaceable. And the men aboard ship knew kind of what the gig was on this. And one of them, you know, said, you know, this could be a tremendous honor. It could be a trap. Another sailor said, you know, I'd rather occupy a den of porcupines, you know, that's sort of this, how dangerous this could be. But the Japanese were true to their word. The Cowpen steamed in and were within a few hundred yards of the battleship Missouri, where the surrender was signed in September 45.
Nathan, let's back up and talk about the battle career of the USS Cowpens. We can talk about the Marianas Turkey Shoot. We sure. Certainly need to talk about Typhoon Cobra.
Yeah. So of all the light carriers, of all the sisters, the things that Cowpens that made her different was that, you know, it was a marathon for her. She was present for more of it than any of her sisters. As you judge by the Navy would give out what's called battle stars to recognize involvement in a battle. And she had 12, which is a pretty remarkable number. Some of the others are only 7 or 9, but she was there essentially for every major carrier operation, starting from Wake Island in the fall of 43, all the way to Tokyo Bay, with the exception of only one. And that was Okinawa. And Okinawa, the only reason she missed Okinawa was by that point she was so battle worn and had been essentially, what's the expression, ridden hard and hung up wet, that she needed about 60 or 90 days in a dry dock to get her problems all sorted. But, you know, they started with these small islands sort of in the Central Pacific, you know, the Gilberts to the Marshall Islands, and then Truk had it's now in the Federated States of Micronesia, had this terrible reputation as sort of being an unassailable Japanese fortress, the Gibraltar of the Pacific. And it was not nearly as bad as expected. So perhaps, you know, the way to describe this is you've got this very green crew and they're kind of shaky. They're not quite sure they can do this. And the targets are getting bigger and more challenging as they go along, and they're gaining in confidence. The crew is as you go. And so by the time you get to the Marianas Turkey Shoot in June of 44, just squadron rotations and the fleet of U.S. fast carriers meant that the Cowpens actually had some of the most experienced fighter pilots around. The way it worked is the crew would stay with the ship from start, but the squadrons would rotate out every 6 to 9 months. So they had come a little late to the game, and a lot of the other, you know, first line squadrons had left. And so these guys at the Turkey Shoot, you know, they were veterans. But every time the squadrons rotated over, they essentially had to start from scratch again with a new set of pilots and getting them up to speed and teaching them how to do these types of operations. But the Turkey Shoot was for a small carrier. She did very well. They think nine confirmed aerial victories, 3 more probables, but they had some problems with their admiral at the time, unfortunately, a Tennessean by the name of Keen Harrell, who, shall we say, was not great at making sure that pilots who were down in a life raft were picked up. And there were several incidences where folks were essentially abandoned. One of them, only 50 miles away from the task force, they saw him, he's in his raft, he's waving, I'm fine. And no one went to pick him up, and he drifted off and was never seen again.
Wow.
Eventually, Admiral Harrell was relieved.
He was, yeah. He was he was the least aggressive of all the admirals there in the Fifth Fleet at that time, and they found a face-saving way to relieve him from command. I think he came down with appendicitis, but, you know, I think they were just looking for an excuse to get rid of him by that point.
And gentlemen, I hate to say this, but we're getting toward the end of our time. So you've mentioned the Typhoon. Maybe we should talk about that.
Yeah, you make the point that Typhoon Cobra posed the biggest threat to the survival of the Mighty Mu than any Japanese military force.
Yeah. I mean, my grandfather didn't talk about combat. He talked about the Typhoon. It terrified him. And with the Cowpens Veterans Association put out a, you know, they asked people to, in the early 80s, they sent out sort of a flyer to all the veterans and say, ask them about the Typhoon. And almost all of them said the exact same thing, that they were absolutely terrified. It was far worse than combat. And, you know, we talked earlier about how the ship was narrow and top heavy. You know, she was rolling in excess of 45 degrees to either side.
Wow.
During this Typhoon. Yeah. The roll meter only went to 45 degrees, and Captain Dubon described how when they did a roll to starboard, the needle would be bouncing off the stop at 45 degrees. So they were probably closer to 50. But it's in the sides of the flight deck, which are 70 feet above the water in calm seas, were dipping into the ocean. The smokestacks were taking water down the smokestacks. And then down in the magazine, it was loaded to beyond capacity because they were supporting operations in the Philippines. The bombs broke loose. So you had 500 and 2,000 pound bombs rolling back and forth across the flight deck with each, you know, sort of lurch of the ship. And the ordnance men charged in the magazine, you know, heat's over 120 degrees, and they're kind of trying to lasso these bombs in place. And they said that they would wait, you know, until there's like a second or a second and a half where the ship was mostly right, and they'd get down there with the rope and try and get them in place. And then they would leap up and hang onto the girders and pull themselves up. So these, you know, these bombs wouldn't essentially roll over them and crush them.
Nathan, you've got a quote from the ship's war diary, and I'm going to read it because it's incredible. The suspense, the terrible moment came each time the ship hung at the end of a starboard roll, waiting to see if she would come back again. Never again do any of us want to look that closely into the face of God. In the countless times that members of this ship have faced Nipponese dive bombers and torpedo bombers, there has never been fear. The dread that prevailed that day as all hands realized that we were in the grip of something bigger and greater and more omnipotent than any human agency.
Yeah. These war diaries are usually pretty clinical. You know, there's not a lot of emotion. It's not very descriptive. There's not a, you know, they're not, it is just a very matter of fact description of what's going on. The fact that they are sort of waxing, you know, I'm not going to say poetic, but they are putting so much into it and describing what their terror was like, I think gives you a good feel that this was, how serious this was. Apparently the public address system, the PA, as the ship would be rolling, would be announcing 40 degrees, 42 degrees, 43, you know, how far they were going to either side. And they had a fire on the flight deck. One of the fighter aircraft, which was fully fueled to fly in case they'd gotten out of the storm, broke loose and was sliding around, and men had to go out onto the flight deck and, you know, get hoses on the fire to prevent it from spreading to the other planes. And they described them as like, they were like mountain climbers. You know, they were lashing themselves to the tie down points on the deck, dragging the hose along behind them. It's just an amazing drama that these guys went through. It's not an exaggeration to say that their margin of survival was very, very narrow, because three destroyers capsized in this storm and killed nearly 800 men. So it was serious. This was no mean storm.
Okay. All right. We need to talk about how the veterans of the Mighty Moo began to congregate in Cowpen, South Carolina, and they still do today. There is a Mighty Moo annual festival on Father's Day every year.
Yeah. I think that's really – that's what makes this story unique. Beyond, you know, sort of the World War II drama, there's nowhere else, no other Navy ship has anything quite like this, where it's tied to a single community in this way. And every year, starting in 1979, and they've only had a couple of years where they didn't do it once when they're just getting started, and more recently because of COVID, they gather every Father's Day and – you know, some of these veterans, and granted, unfortunately, many of them, the World War II veterans have passed, did this for 20, 30 years, you know, straight every year in Cowpens. They'd come home to Cowpens, and, you know, they had an adopter, you know, every crew member had a family that had adopted them. They did a banquet to celebrate and go. I mean, it's become this whole small town festival that is centered around the Cowpens veterans. And now there is a second Cowpens, a cruiser, and their crew, the ship is commissioned in 89, are regulars too. So you had this amazing mixing of the generations between the World War II sailors and the post-Cold War sailors who would come to Cowpens every year. It's really remarkable. I just don't know of anyone else that does this for the Navy in this way.
Did your grandfather ever participate?
He didn't. I think Grandpa was fundamentally uncomfortable with his wartime years, and don't get me wrong, he was also kind of a bit of an introvert and not necessarily particularly social. He was just, you know, kind of a private person. So it was not the sort of thing that he would do. I'm sorry. I think he really would have enjoyed it. I think it would have been good for him, for these veterans who went through these very traumatic experiences, to actually go and meet people that went through these things with them and talk it out. And, you know, some of the families would say that, you know, my father would never talk about this, but when he came to Cowpens, you know, it would all come out of him. That, you know, it also gave people an opportunity to resolve some regrets. There was an amazing story told by one of the townspeople that he was talking to a pilot who'd served aboard ship, and the man had crashed on deck and, you know, his plane was in flames. And one of the crewmen, the deck crew, pulled him out, helped get him out. So he saved his life. And the pilot says, you know, I've always regretted, you know, this was like in the 90s. So, you know, years and years that I never had the opportunity to tell that man, thank you. And he says, that's really bothered me. And Bobby, the guy who lives there in Cowpens, says, well, why don't you? He's right over there. Hmm. And so it gave him the opportunity to get something like that off his chest. So, you know, it would have been, I hope, you know, maybe that was something that my grandfather could have used. I'm sorry he didn't participate.
Yeah. Have you yourself attended one of these?
Yeah, I've been three times. I'll be there again this summer, bringing my family this time. This will be the first time there in Cowpens. Perhaps this year will be a little sadder than usual, that we've just learned that the new Cowpens is actually going to be decommissioned in August. It's been 30 years. So, you know, it was a natural point for the Navy to say, we either really invest in this ship, and they actually put $145 million into, you know, trying to repair and get another decade or two out of her, or we decommission her. And I think they're going to decommission her. But, you know, with luck, you know, you have to remember the first Cowpens was because the Cowpens town said, we need a ship. The second Cowpens was the same story. They lobbied with Congress and with the Navy for a ship bearing their name. And with any luck, there'll be a third one.
One hopes.
Okay.
One hopes.
Well, any last words, Nathan, before we sign off today?
Well, thanks very much. I know I really do appreciate you having me here. You know, South Carolina's got an acute sense of history and you know, how it's played into some tremendous dramas. And this is an overlooked story, but I think one that is important, and I think people will enjoy.
And in many ways, it's a story bigger than the state. It's all part of our country's history.
It's the great things that we can do together when we're united.
All right. Nathan Canestaro, I want to thank you today for being with us on The Journal.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation today. I know that I did. The story of the USS Cowpens is a remarkable one, and USS Cowpens service has become the wellspring for a remarkable modern tradition, both within the U.S. Navy and the small South Carolina town that still celebrates her legacy with a festival every year.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. I'm Alfred Turner, and I produce the show, which is made possible by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina. Remember, the views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio or its underwriters.
New episodes of Walter Edgar's Journal are published on the first and third Fridays of the month, and are available at southcarolinapublicradio.org, on the SCETV app, as well as your favorite podcast provider. We'll talk again soon.